This is the lecture on value, utility, and price. It's a companion lecture to the one on Wednesday, which takes up further explorations in value and utility theory. In that second lecture, we'll provide criticisms and discussions of alternative approaches to price theory. In this lecture, we just want to lay out the straight Austrian view of the relationship between value and price. So let's begin with the most basic concept of Austrian economics and human action. Human action we know is purposeful behavior, that is, it's directed toward attaining an end. Or we could say that the motive a person has for acting is to attain the end. But clearly having an end that one wishes to attain doesn't constitute action. A person must be able to recognize the cause and effect connection between things that exist in the external world and the attainment of his end. That is, he has to be able to conceive of the existence of means and then, of course, come to control the use of these means in action. Now, as you probably heard or read in the Austrian literature, we begin Austrian economics with the fundamental axiom of economics that human action exists. This is called an axiom because it's, as Aristotle would say, self-evidently true. Any attempt to demonstrate that this proposition is false is an action that has the purpose of so demonstrating, employs means to the attainment of this end, and so on. But also we know certain things about human action, not just by this logical claim, but by what Murray Rothbard called reflection. That is, all of economic thought begins by just contemplating what the nature of acting is. And so we just think in our own mind about action. We think about the distinction between ends and means, the principle of valuing something, of establishing a preference, a rank order of different valuations. We recognize by reflection the difference between an action that succeeds and one that fails, or that in every action we always aim at psychic profit, and so on. All of these basic principles or concepts of economics are really understood by us by this reflective process. Now let's begin with the one important point about this relationship between value and price. And this is the claim that only individuals act, that when we think about human action, we recognize immediately that it's only done by the human person. This proposition is to rule out something like a collective entity that engages in action. Now, if we rule out a collective entity that engages in action, we must also rule out any notion of collective value. That is, value must also reside in the mind of the individual persons who are engaged in action. But once we recognize that, we also see that there's a difficulty that will present itself when we think about the market economy, about the division of labor. If we have different people with different valuations, they're making in their own minds about what's a proper end and what are suitable means to the attainment of these ends. And yet they're producing and consuming in a division of labor where they're not self-sufficient in production, but they're producing in order to satisfy the consumptive ends of others and having their consumptive ends satisfied by the production of other people. Then we seem to have the problem of how do we reconcile these individual valuations so that we come up with something like a suitable social rank of value, so that we can say, yes, these people over here should be doing X to satisfy the valuations that are made by other people, because they can, in fact, in some way, make a comparison of those valuations to the valuations of other people. How do we reconcile all these different valuations? And in a sense, this is the main task of price theory, is to show how individual valuations can be reconciled in such a way that they become suitable for economizing decisions in the division of labor. Now, having said that, let's just begin again with some very basic concepts. the first on our way to thinking about value in the Austrian sense is to recognize that means are scarce. Any action implies an unmet end. But if a person has an end that is not yet met, then the means he applies to action must be scarce to him. And yet, of course, in the face of scarcity, people act. This implies that means are allocated by the person acting. In other words, a person is able to choose between competing ends, which end is preferable, which end he finds more valuable to pursue, and setting aside then an end that is less valued. Now, the reason why choice, the choice between competing ends in the face of scarce means, is done by valuation, or what we mean when we use this word valuation, just refers to what we said before about human action, that human action is purposeful. So value refers simply to the purpose that, or the benefit of achieving the purpose that the person has in mind who's engaged in the action. Now, choosing between two things, of course, requires setting side by side these valuations, establishing what in economics we call a preference, so that we're able to say, I prefer one course of action over another. This is all that's logically required for choice to take place. Now, we would say it this way then, that a preference rank between two options in acting is ordinal. You simply say one thing is better and another not as good, so that there are no cardinal numbers attached to these rank order positions that a person establishes in his mind when deciding to act. Also, when we talk about preference, we need to recognize that preference is simply the word that we use in economics to refer to the judgment of value that the acting person makes. So preference is always bound up in action. Preference is just that ranking of value that by which a person chooses to act one way and not another. So preference is not divorced from action. Preference isn't something that stands outside of action. Or to use the phrase that Murray Rothbard used, preference is demonstrated in action. It's only when a person acts that we, as an outsider, see that person's preference. Now, two more additional points, basic points here about value. One thing, when we engage in a valuation of an end or a means, this value is subjective. And by subjective, the Austrians have in mind that value is simply a state of mind. It's a judgment of the mind. It resides in the mind. In other words, it has no external property. Nothing about it exists outside of the mind. Now, because of this, of course, it won't be possible to do something like measure value. Because it isn't possible to determine what we might call a unit of value. Right? Such a unit could never be decided or agreed upon among different individuals if value just resides in my mind and your value resides in your mind. There's no such thing as a useful private unit of value. This unit has to be public, right? It has to be shared in order to measure something. The thing must have an extensive property that we independently agree has a certain characteristic that could be a measurable characteristic. So we cannot measure value. We cannot then establish cardinal units for value. We can't do arithmetic operations with value. We can't add values together, subtract one from another, and so on and so forth. And in fact, to some degree, this point is recognized even in the mainstream. The debates that occurred in the early part of the 20th century about a welfare theory basically left the debate with the claim accepted by all the participants that it isn't possible to have cardinal utility. And so we simply can't directly compare different individuals' valuations. We can't reconcile these valuations, as I said before, by some kind of direct comparison. Now, a second important element, though, or feature of value, completely distinct from its subjectivity, is that value is not constant. In other words, there is no constant quantitative relationship between external circumstances that we value and the value we place on them. The valuation is a judgment of our mind that we make of these circumstances. And there's nothing fixed about it or constant in any sort of quantitatively definite way. We know this, by the way, because when we reflect upon action, we recognize that sometimes we have regrets. In other words, we recognize that in the exact same circumstances, we could have acted differently, but didn't, and therefore regret it. If these external circumstances somehow had to give us a quantitatively definite value and then an action based upon that value, regret would be a meaningless notion to us. So, what follows from this point about no constant relationships, of course, is that we can't engage in any kind of mathematical formalism with respect to utility. This is because, as Mises puts it, there are no constants. There are no quantitatively definite constants that we could use in some sort of functional expression of utility. And, of course, the same thing then applies to demand. In other words, demand is a relationship between two cardinal unit elements, prices and quantities, also has no mathematical representation, not because you're, in this case, working with subjective units, you know, assuming that they're cardinal units of value, but because there are no constants between these two elements in action. Okay, now, as I suggested on Wednesday, we'll take up the question of how mainstream economists try to get around this difficulty, how they try to square the circle by having their ordinal utility on the one hand and yet their mathematical representations of demand and utility functions and so on the other. But now we'll just push ahead with these basic principles. And so next we might point out that just like value in action, cost in action is also subjective. Fundamentally, at least, it's subjective. The cost of an action is just the value of the alternative action that could have been taken but was rejected because it lacked the higher value of the option chosen. So when doing price theory, Austrians focus then on what's in the mainstream called opportunity cost. Right, the only cost relevant for our discussion about prices and so on is opportunity cost. Now, it would also follow then that the basic idea of net benefit or profit in action is also subjective. Psychic profit, as Mises and Rothbard called it. So we might say that all action aims at profit. There's an entrepreneurial judgment, bring to bear our foresight upon how the action will work out when we decide to pursue a course of action, estimating or anticipating this value that we're striving for. And then, of course, there can be an ex post accounting of this psychic profit. We can look back on the action and say, yes, it did succeed, or no, it didn't, or I got more value, net value than I thought, or less, and so on. Or to use another summary concept, one that's more useful for our further discussions, we could say that action is economizing. And by economizing, what we mean is that a person takes a given means and applies that means to the highest valued end, whatever they prefer the most, in other words. This is just how we use the word preference. If a person could think of a even more highly valued end to pursue at that moment with those means, that's the one he would choose then. The fact that he pursues this particular course of action demonstrates, as we suggested before, that he values it most highly relative to his alternatives. We can also look at economizing from the viewpoint of the means. We could say, for a given end, a person will always strive to attain this end with the least cost means. This is because if he can economize on the means, if he can expend less valuable means to attain that end, he he can hold in reserve more valuable means than to attain another end. And then the final basic concept that we want to introduce here is the concept of imputed value. An imputed value says that the value of means are given to them, hence the word imputed, are given to them from the value of the end and the aid that the means gives in the attainment of the end, the actual physical cause and effect connection between this means and the end. So value is imputed from the mind to the goods that are used as means to attain an end. We might provide a schematic like this. So that value goes from the mind to consumer goods, and then from consumer goods to factors of production. Now, the basic reason why value is imputed in this direction, sort of unidirectional, I think Rothbard calls this backwards imputation. The reason why value is imputed in this way is because all production aims at a consumptive end. The only reason we engage in action at all is to attain the end. And so every productive act, we use the factors of production to create a consumer good, is done only for that consumptive end. And therefore, it must be aiming at the attainment of a consumptive value, the value that we have in our minds, assessing the benefit of achieving this end. Now, you'll notice, again, this is something we'll talk about in the lecture on Wednesday. You notice that the schematic could be reversed. We could reverse the arrows this way. If we reverse the arrows, we would have forward imputation, we might call this. An example of this would be a cost of production theory of value, right? The value is somehow inherent in the factors of production. And when we use these factors in a productive act, this value is transmitted to the consumer goods, and then presumably to complete the argument, this value would have to be recognized by our minds. We would have to assent to this value in our minds. So this is the cost of production theory the most famous example. This would be the labor theory of value. Then we could also have this, or we do also have this competing theory where the value of a consumer good is jointly determined by subjective value in our mind and intrinsic value of the factors of production. This is a Marshallian sort of argument, right? That the price of a good is the value of the consumer good is determined jointly by cost of production and subjective value. Again, we'll treat these variations on Wednesday. So just to summarize where we've gone so far, we say that an individual person economizes in action by establishing preferences, preferring one thing over another, assimilating the means, valuing the means with respect to the end, and so on. Now, as I suggested before, though, the main problem of price theory is this problem of reconciling these individual valuations as people come into a division of labor. In a production system of self-sufficiency, this question wouldn't arise. We wouldn't have to reconcile individual valuations. Each person would just directly value the means and the ends. But in a division of labor, this can't economize. In a division of labor, the producer and the consumer are different persons. And so the producer has to be able to compare the valuation somehow of different consumers in order to know what's more valuable to other people to produce. So this is where the problem arises. Now, as Mises puts it, the solution to this problem is the principle of what he calls appraisement. So while an individual person engages in economizing decisions by valuation, establishing an ordinal rank of value in his mind, in society, decisions about the use of factors of production in the division of labor can only be undertaken by appraisement. Now, appraisement is arithmetic computation with monetary entries. The two basic monetary entries are net income, or profit, and net worth, or equity. Now, first let's just rehearse why valuation can't be used to do this reconciliation, that is, to make economizing decisions within the division of labor. Well, to look at the ends first, in order to economize, as remember we said before, given means had to be applied to the highest valued ends. So some objective determination of highest valued has to be available to us. When we engage in our own action, this, as we suggested before, is just what we do in our own minds. We're able to establish this judgment in our own minds. This is simple. We do this every day in all our actions. There's no problem here, at least no theoretical problem. But in society, we would have competing valuations made by different persons. And it would seem that there are only two possible ways to go about reconciling these, about saying, my valuation for one thing is greater than yours, or yours is greater than mine. One possible route would be just to have an independent third party decide between us. We might call the dictator option. We just have a dictator, a wise, benevolent kind of dictator, decide between us, if there is such a thing. And the problem here, though, of course, is precisely that values are subjective. In order to have an actual, the actual ranking order established between two different people's valuations, the third party would have to be able to experience them both. This is the only way that he could objectively, scientifically establish such a preference rank. This, of course, he cannot do. No human could do this. The only other option open to us is to find some way to directly compare these valuations. But again, as we suggested before, this is a dead end. There isn't any way to directly compare the rank orders of values made by different individuals objectively. We could never establish then a social rank, if you will, of ordinal preferences. Then the second problem, remember the second dimension of economizing is about the factors of production. How do we value the factors of production? And here we have a similar kind of difficulty. Again, the basic costs that we're trying to keep down in the division of labor or in action are opportunity costs. These opportunity costs reside in the minds of the persons who own the factors of production that would put them into different uses in the division of labor. Again, there are only two options open to reconciling these different opportunity costs. One would be to have the dictator do it. But again, this seems problematic. I mean, here the dictator could certainly bypass it might be possible for the dictator to bypass experiencing the opportunity costs of different people. He might be able just to do this just by experiencing himself all of the different activities in the division of labor. Right? And then he could just establish in his own mind what he thought the different opportunities costs were, of these different options. But again, this is why it won't work, right? The division of labor is precisely that social arrangement in which not every person can do everything. So no dictator, no human person would ever be able to actually experience all the different jobs in the division of labor to have in his mind the rank order of these different options. So we're just left again with direct comparison, but again we get nowhere here. So this is just recounting again Mises' argument here about why we can't use direct evaluation to solve this problem. The solution to the problem, as Mises points out, is to have all preferences of goods and factors of production for and against money. All of our preferences are in the common unit of money. This doesn't make our preferences directly comparable, but it leaves results from our actions that do permit us to make comparisons. We can say one person's valuation for a particular good relative to money is stronger than another person's valuation of the same good relative to money. And that's all we need to do in order to make economizing decisions. Now, as I suggested before, then, the role of price theory in this particular view of things we might write out the schematic this way. We start with preferences, and then preferences give us the supply of goods and the demand for goods. And maybe I should just stop to make a clarifying remark here about preferences. In this schematic, we're not arguing here that, so to speak, there's nothing prior to preferences. That's not the claim. In other words, there are all sorts of facts about the world that we're valuing, all sorts of elements, you know, that exist in the world that are, if you will, preconditions to our action. The point is that action, in order to engage in action, all those things have to be filtered through our mental judgments. They only come into play in action when we value them. When we say in our mind, yes, this is a suitable means to attain this end. Yes, this is a proper end to pursue. So this is what we mean when we set preference at the top of this diagram. I'm not, again, claiming that nothing precedes it, but simply that everything comes through it, and therefore it has preeminence, if you will, theoretically. Okay, so from preferences of goods for and against money, we get supply of goods and demand. This then gives us prices of the goods, right? That's the first step of price theory, to show how we go from preferences through demand and supply to the prices of goods. The prices of goods then generate costs for the consumers. And revenue. For the entrepreneurs who sell these goods. Revenue for the entrepreneurs then generate demand for the factors, or their preconditions for demand for the factors. So entrepreneurs have to earn revenues from selling their goods to the consumers in order to have funds that they can then use to demand the factors of production. Again, we'll talk about what that demand depends upon. That's part of price theory too, right? What determines that demand. But we can just see in the schematic that it depends fundamentally on consumer demands, on the preferences that people have. Then the supply of factors comes from the owners of these factors of production. In other words, it's just based upon preferences again, right? The owners of the factors of production just say, oh, I prefer selling my labor for this amount of money. I prefer renting my land for this amount of money. They just establish the preferences in their own minds between the factors and sums of money. Then these two come together, supply the factors and demand, gives the price of the factors. Prices of the factors generate costs for the entrepreneurs who produce the goods, and incomes for the producers, or you might say for the owners of the factors of production. So price theory is really just filling in the theoretical flesh on this set of bones. And let me just say one remark, though, in general about this view. This view critically depends upon what we might call monetary incentives. It's the operation of the price system, pricing of the goods and the factors and so on, depends crucially upon monetary incentives. So that, for example, the entrepreneur gives incentive to a worker to come and work in that part of the division of labor by paying income. The consumer is giving incentive to conserve on the use of some good by a higher price. The entrepreneur has incentive to earn profit because he earns this profit as income, and so on. The market economy does not depend upon motives that people have. People can have a diversity of motives. It doesn't really matter. But the market economy cannot operate, the division of labor can't be constructed and maintained and improved without the ability of you and I and others to give each other monetary incentives. Okay, now these, as we suggested, these prices then permit the calculation of the two basic forms of appraisement, net income by the entrepreneur, revenue from the sale of goods. This is up here, revenue from for the entrepreneurs when they sell their goods, netting out the costs that the entrepreneurs incur for hiring the factors of production. Mark, I'll get the technician up here. That's better. Okay, so from the top?
Yeah.
Sure. Preferences at the top give us supply of goods on the left-hand side, demand for goods on the right. Supply and demand determine prices for those goods. The prices of the goods generate revenue for the entrepreneurs who sell the goods and costs for the consumers who buy the goods. The revenue for entrepreneurs then constrains their demand for the factors of production. The supply of the factors of production comes from people's preferences, just like the supply of goods. Supply of the factors and demand for the factors determine the prices of the factors. Prices of the factors generate costs for the entrepreneurs who are producing these goods, and income for the producers, income for the owners of the factors of production. So net income is used by the entrepreneurs to make economizing production decisions, we might call these. How to use existing factors of production, how to estimate or at least anticipate when the factors are being employed in lines that are valued by the consumers more, when they're being employed in lines that are valued by the consumers less. Then the other basic calculation is a net worth or equity. This is assets minus liabilities, the capital value of your assets of the enterprise minus its liabilities. And net worth or equity is the means by which entrepreneurs appraise and make economizing decisions about capital investment. Right? Not about the use of existing factors, but what to do in the capital structure to change the factors of production. How do we improve them? How do we add to them? And so on. So this can be determined by assessing the value that those improvements have, the value of the capital improvement, next to the liabilities that must be incurred in order to bring that improvement about. And again, all we're doing at this point is just giving you a schematic, right? I mean, we have all the theories yet to be filled in here. Okay, so let's start that process, the process of filling in the theory. And let's begin just with this first step, right, going from preferences to the prices of goods. This is the easiest step and obviously the first. Now, this demonstration depends upon what the Austrians call the laws of utility. And these laws of utility are derived directly from the two principles that we spoke about before, economizing and imputation. And I'll go through the demonstration in a minute. Now, the other aspect that needs to be kept in mind in doing this demonstration is that the laws of utility would only apply logically. We could only derive them to be logically implied in action under certain conditions of acting. And these conditions are that we look at any particular action. That is, we're just looking at some particular action. We're not, in other words, looking at a sequence of action over time, but just any particular action. And second, that this action takes place, or at least could conceivably take place, with what Rothbard liked to call equally serviceable units of a good. Now, by equally serviceable units, Rothbard means that any one unit of the good is sufficient to satisfy any one end to which it could be put by the actor. So any one unit is suitable to satisfy any one end. Notice then the units are interchangeable. In other words, what this assumption is or condition is ruling out for us is the possibility that in this discussion of the laws we develop, the laws of utility, that a person could value different units of a good on the basis of, let's say, their physical characteristics. He has a red car and a blue car, and he likes red better. We're isolating out that fact. We're not saying that that might not happen. We're just saying that the laws of utility apply only when we're not considering that factor. We're holding that particular condition about units of a good of the same. Now, one might at this point raise the question of, well, how realistic is this? I mean, why do we make this particular assumption? Can we get away with this, so to speak, and still have a theory that has direct applicability to the real world? Or are we just doing what we accuse the neoclassical economists of doing all the time, making pie-in-the-sky assumptions about things? But again, it doesn't take too much effort to see that equally serviceable units actually is a predominant condition in the market. Remember, we're just using this theory to explain prices in the market. It's not a, you know, necessarily a general theory about all acting. In fact, units in the market tend to come not only in equally serviceable units, but in physically identical units. Right? Gallons of 87 octane gasoline, 16-ounce loaves of Roman meal bread, and so on. Prices that exist in the market exist for equally serviceable units of goods, not for units of goods that are not equally serviceable. Right? There's no such thing as the price of gasoline or the price of bread. There are only prices for equally serviceable units of something. Now, of course, it could be the case that there is only one unit of a good, and there we wouldn't have this condition met. But in most of our activity in the market, we do act, or we are facing a situation, a circumstance of our acting, where there are equally serviceable units available to us. So this is a perfectly reasonable assumption. Okay, so let's see how economizing and imputation work in given this condition. And let's just use a concrete example. Bumbavrik was fond of using horses, but we sort of moved past the horse age. So let's just use automobiles. It's not very inventive, but serves our purpose. So let's say we have a guy who owns a Honda Civic. Let's say it's a 2-year-old Honda Civic. And he applies it to some particular end. Let's say he uses it to commute to work every day. So we know by the principle of demonstrated preference, this is his most highly valued use. He's applying it to whatever end he believes to be most valued. And so he imputes a certain value to the car based upon the value of that end that he satisfies. If he could think of a more highly valued end, then he would be allocating it that way, right? That's the logic of economizing. He must be allocating it to what he considers most highly valued. Now, if the Honda Civic is an equally serviceable unit, then the car as a unit satisfies completely that end to which he's putting it, commuting. So now we just ask this question. What would this guy do if he had a second Honda Civic that, for our purposes, let's say, is just physically identical to the first or equally serviceable, interchangeably useful with the first? Well, he would, if he considered it a good at all, he would have to apply it to an end that he found less valuable. He would, for example, he might let his friends borrow it during the day. Something like that. They run errands with it or something like this. Or rent it out, maybe, to somebody. But whatever he might envision. If, of course, he can't envision any end that could be met with this unit of the good, then, of course, this thing is not a good, and the laws of utility don't apply to it. But that could happen. So laws of utility only apply when we have goods. Okay, so it must follow from the principle of imputation, then, that he would impute less value to that second car as opposed to the first. And in fact, if he crashed his first car the one he was actually using for the commuting, he would immediately take his second car and reapply it to commuting. There's nothing about the car that, in our construction, nothing about the second car that makes it inferior as a car. It's equally serviceable. Okay, so now we see these two laws of utility. The first law of utility is often called the law of diminishing marginal utility, which says that the larger the stock of a good, the lower the utility or value of the marginal unit. So the larger the stock of the good, the lower the utility of the marginal unit. The second law of utility says that a larger stock of a good is preferred to a smaller stock. So this guy prefers two cars to one or three to two, as long as these added units are still within the range that make the thing a good. Again, he could have 100 cars and then perhaps not consider them a good anymore. Okay, so if he can satisfy more ends, that's better than being able to satisfy fewer, and so more of the means is preferred as opposed to fewer units of the means. Okay, so it's these two laws upon which the laws of demand and supply depend. All we have to do here, and we're skipping over a lot of discussion that'll be backfilled later in the week, but all we have to do to go from the laws of utility to demand and supply is interject all of the conditions for market exchange. Now, we have to have buyers who have money, who have certain preference rankings that make it suitable for them to engage in exchange with sellers who have goods. The preferences have to be reversed. Remember the basic precondition of exchange and so on. And again, we're just skipping over that. Assuming that you all know this, we can just proceed directly to our demonstration. And so the demonstration might look something like this. Let's say we have a buyer of Honda Civics. We'll call him buyer A. And his value scale looks like this. Which simply means that if he were in the market, and we're again supposing that there is a market and trade going on and so on, if he were in the market and the price of the Honda Civic was $15,000, he would buy it. If it were $16,000, he wouldn't. Okay, so that's his preference for the Civic relative to money. Now, the way we go, of course, to the law of demand is simply in the same way that we went to the laws of utility. We just ask this question. Since we know that, or we're presuming, that additional units of the good, and having another Honda Civic is valuable to this person, why doesn't he buy the second one? Why does he stop his purchasing at one unit? And the answer can only be because the second unit must be less valued to him. The second unit, if we would conjecture where it might rank on his value scale, would rank somewhere below, right? Somewhere down here. Now notice this is just a conjecture that we make. Let's say, just to have a number, let's say that the second Honda Civic he would actually buy if the price in the market were $10,000 per car. Then he would buy two. We don't know this, but it's implied by the laws of utility, right? Only at a lower price then would the quantity purchased be larger. This is the law of demand. Or again, to say this strictly speaking, the law of demand would be defined this way. We would say, for a given purchase, if the price would have been lower, the quantity purchase would have either been larger or the same. Now, in order to have a market, though, at least to have a theory of price determination, we can't settle just for one buyer and one seller. Again, for those of you who are more advanced, we just skip over this with one comment. If we just have one buyer and one seller in the market, we don't have a theory of price determination. The price would be determined by bargaining within a range between the minimum price the seller is willing to accept and the maximum the buyer is willing to pay. But if we have multiple buyers and multiple sellers, then price becomes determinant. And so we want to move to that condition. Now here we introduce an auxiliary premise into our discussion, and this auxiliary premise is that different people have different preferences. Different people are different to some degree. They're different in what they like and dislike. They're different in their skills, in their interests, energy, and so on. Not too shocking of a claim, but I guess it should be noted an empirical claim, right? The world could be different than this. Now, if this is so, then let's just introduce, as we've done for buyer A, some more buyers. Let's say we also have buyer B, and let's consider buyer B's preferences less intense than buyer A. So we could say, for example, that buyer A is more eager than buyer B. He has preferences that are more intense for the good. He values the good more relative to money than buyer B does. And then let's add one more. Call this person buyer C, and make buyer C the least eager buyer. Let's say at $12,000 he'd be a bit out of the market, but he's willing to pay $11,000. So we can see the pattern of demand for the market that's implied in this particular set of buyers. If the price happened to be $15,000, well, then only buyer A would buy. One would be demanded by the buyers. If the price happened to be 13 instead of 15, then two, right? Both A and B would buy under that situation. Only if the price were 11,000 would buyer C come in. So notice if we were to draw a demand curve here for the market, that as we move down the demand curve, there we're introducing additional buyers. Buyers who are only potentially in the market when prices are high would come into the market at lower prices. And buyers who would be in the market at low prices are bid out of the market by the competitive bidding of more eager buyers offering higher prices. Okay, now the other side of the market, of course, looks very similar. Let's say we have, let's start with seller X. Seller X, remember, we're presupposing has a Honda Civic to sell, maybe two. You know, he's got some of the good to sell, and he has certain preferences, given that he has a certain amount of money, other conditions that exist by which he establishes these preferences. And let's say that his preference ranking looks this way. That he would be willing to accept now $11,000 in trade to give up his a Honda Civic. First, but I use the word first just to indicate it's highest ranked, right? First ranked or second ranked and so on. If he had two cars, this would be a second ranked car. So anyway, he would be willing, he's fairly eager, he's willing to sell $11,000 for whatever reason. And then if there are other sellers in the market, let's make them less eager. Let's say that Y would only sell at $13,000. Let's say seller Z would only come in the market if the price were 15. And so again, we see illustrated in this example the law of supply. Remember, the argument is just the companion to the law of demand. In other words, we say, let's take seller X. Let me change the situation slightly. Let's say that seller X sells his, let's say he has two Honda Civics, and at $11,000 he's willing to sell one of them. And then the question is, why doesn't he sell both? If he's willing to sell one of them, why doesn't he sell both? And the only answer is, well, the other one must be worth more to him. That's why he's not selling it. But by the conditions of equal serviceability, it can't be worth more to him because he likes it more. You know, it's red and not blue, or it runs better, it gets better gas mileage, or whatever other physical difference might exist. He values it only because he's putting it to a more valued end. So only if the price were higher would he be willing to sell that unit. This is the law of supply, right? It's just the companion argument to the law of demand. Okay, and then we also see that the law of supply would emerge in the market because some sellers are more eager to sell, willing to sell at lower prices. Some can only be brought into the market if prices are higher. They're less eager sellers who would come in at higher prices. Now, all of that analytics is just to get us to this argument. This is the argument, right, about price. So now we've got the background, laws of utility, laws of demand and supply. We can go to the conclusion. And the conclusion is about what we call the market clearing price. So let's just have a little chart here to summarize our market. We know that if the price happened to be 15,000, we'd have one demanded and three supplied. At 14,000, we'd have one and two. At 13,000, we have two and two. At 12,000, we have two and one. 11,000, we have three and one. We say that the market clearing price, well, it's the price that clears the market, right? It's the price where the amount bought and the amount sold are the same.
On the seller, should they be reversed? Should the first car he sells be, like for seller X, would he sell his first car at 10,000 and then the second car be 11,000 because he'd be more likely to sell his first car than his second car?
Yes, if he had multiple cars. Uh-huh. Right, you're right. In this particular case, I just presume that each of the sellers has one car.
Okay.
And so that difficulty doesn't arise, but you're quite right to point that out. Okay, so the market clearing price we just define as the price where the quantity demand, quantity supplied are the same. This, again, is just a definitional claim. At any other price, of course, we don't have this condition met. This is why we call this price determination. As long as we have competition among the buyers and competition among the sellers, theory can give us a determinate price. Now, the argument that we have to establish is that the actual price in the market, the real actual price of anything in the market, clears the market, is the market clearing price. That's the argument part, right? We've just defined what the market clearing is. We want to show, in other words, that no other price can persist in the market, that every price is a market clearing price. So the argument then goes like this. The first proposition to state it in summary form is we would state it this way, that only at the market clearing price are the preferences of all the buyers and all the sellers satisfied. Everyone, every buyer, every seller has his preferences satisfied only at the market clearing price. At any other price, either some of the sellers or some of the buyers will be dissatisfied. But of course, we know people don't undergo action to be dissatisfied. They undergo action only to have their preferences satisfied. And so they won't act in such a way that their preferences are not satisfied. At least they won't do this intentionally, right? So that's the basic argument in capsule form. Now let's go through a little bit more rigorous demonstration. Let's just see what would happen if prices differed from a market clearing and why then they won't. So let's start with a high price. Let's say the $15,000 price, where one is demanded and three supplied. All the sellers want to sell, but let's say only the most eager buyer, buyer A, wants to buy. Now, the demonstration then is, why won't sellers ask prices at this high level? It would seem that it would be in sellers' interest to ask prices, if they could fetch them, as high as possible, right? Sure, we don't have to worry about buyers asking prices or bidding prices way up here. We only have to worry theoretically about or logically about the sellers. So what restrains the sellers? And the answer, of course, we suggested before, is that sellers' preferences will not be satisfied at this $15,000 price. Let's say, for example, that seller Z makes the sale, the least eager seller makes the sale at 15,000, then X and Y are unsatisfied, right? At that price, they want to sell too, but they can't. There are no buyers. So they won't sit still for this. They'll preempt seller Z from getting the sale. They'll recognize right away, if they're good entrepreneurs, their expectations will even lead them to set the price at the market clearing level. All the sellers have the same incentive to do this, right? The market clearing level is that level where they're getting the highest price they can given demand. If they ask prices above this, they won't sell the product. They won't sell some portion of the product that they wish to sell. This is what they find unsatisfactory. And this is why they don't ask prices above the market clearing price. The same thing, or the symmetric thing, then would be true about prices below market clearing. Right, the $11,000 price, to take the extreme example in our case. Say, why don't buyers ask or just make bids at $11,000? It would seem that buyers always want to pay low prices. Sellers, of course, aren't interested in asking prices down in the basement like that. What restrains the buyers? Is if they make an offer of to buy a car at $11,000, they won't buy it. No seller will step forward to sell to them. This is unsatisfactory to them, at least if their preferences are such as we have here, right? So there's some buyers who would be willing then to ask higher prices to cut out less eager buyers to compete, to offer a competitive bid above this price. And they'll even do this to preempt the sale, right? They'll do this in advance. They'll anticipate this. I mean, all of us know that if we want to actually buy a car, and there's a market price that we have known from the immediate past, that we have to offer bids in this range, right? We anticipate this. It isn't that we go to somebody, let's say a car dealer who has a Honda Civic for sale for $13,000, and we say, look, I'll give you 10, and then insist, right? No, you won't be sold a car. If your preferences are such that you're willing to pay 13. Well, that's not satisfactory to you, and therefore you won't do it. There's no point in doing it. So this is the way the argument runs about market clearing. Now, let me just say before I do that, that about the other part of this schematic, remember the lower part of this about factor prices and so on, we'll cover that in the Wednesday lecture. But let me just conclude with a couple of comments about market clearing prices, just to bring out the distinctive features of this sort of price theory from the mainstream. To reiterate, market clearing prices the Austrians conceive of as the actual prices of goods in markets. The actual price right now of a good in a market clears the market. It's a market clearing price. These are not then hypothetical prices. These are not long-run equilibrium prices, for example, that we're talking about. Now, these are not general equilibrium prices. There may be some purpose to these sorts of constructs, but the Austrian theory is fundamentally about actual prices. Now, the reason why Austrians focus on actual prices is because, of course, it's these prices that are useful in economizing. It's these prices that entrepreneurs, consumers, producers actually have as the basis for or as an input into making their economizing decisions. They don't have hypothetical prices, right? Long-run prices or general equilibrium prices. They just have actual prices. And so this is what needs to be explained. One has to go then from actual prices to decisions to act and then outcomes from that and then so on. And then finally, let me reiterate a point also that I made earlier about this analysis, that these prices, these market clearing prices, are not influenced by production costs. Remember, in our schematic, we're saying that the cause and effect chain runs down the diagram. So costs of production come at the end. We go from the mine to the consumer good to the factors of production. And so unlike mainstream expositions of price theory, costs of production don't enter in a direct way to the determination of prices. It's not like you have a demand curve that's subjective value, a supply curve that's based on production costs. The supply curve, if you will, in the Austrian view, is based just upon opportunity costs, right? Just upon preferences that people have. Okay, at that point I'll stop. Questions?